G'day team, welcome to another instalment of the U Project. I'm getting chastised before we even get underway by Tiffany Ann Cook over there at TYP Central. Good. It's 3 minutes past eight on a Friday night. We normally don't do that, do we?
Happy Friday night, boss. Hanging out with Harps on a Friday night, no?
Yeah, that's right. Happy lockdown Friday night. Yeah, coming at you live from Hampton and other places. Well, you know, we roll on, don't we? Julian Treasure is not in lockdown. He is not in Hampton. He is not in Elwood, where you live. And it's not winter where he is. It's summer. Hi, Julian.
Hello. Good to be here. And all of that is roughly true, actually, up here off the north coast of Scotland.
Oh, are you in Scotland?
Yeah, off the north coast of it. Island archipelago called Orkney. And it's literally 20 miles off the north coast of Scotland.
How do we spell Orkney?
O-R-K-N-E-Y.
What's the population of Orkney?
22,000 in all of the islands. There's five inhabited islands.
See, it's a little geography lesson for you and I, Tiff. I want you to look that up. I want you to find out all about Orkney. Well, thank you. Thank you for joining us. And everyone that we talk to who's not in Australia, which is about 6 out of 10 guests these days, we just ask them for the quick snapshot of their COVID experience. How have you gone through all of it, and how are you currently going with it, and how has it impacted stuff for you?
Well, professionally, it's had impacted me massively. Personally, up here in Orkney, we've had very little of it, actually. I mean, they locked us down quite early on, so nobody was able to get here from the outside. And so I think we had maybe 30 cases in total up until quite recently. It's a little bit more now because the Delta variant is spreading through the UK, and they've opened all the tourist routes. So we get, believe it or not, we're one of the Europe's biggest ocean liner destinations. So we get these ships coming in with 6,000 people on them, absolutely vast things, you know, 12, 15 stories.
Wow.
And they disgorge, you know, 25% of our population in a day. So I know they're all taking great care, but we've got lots of people coming up on ferries and so forth. So I imagine that we'll be riddled with Delta just like the rest of the world will be. But that's the future, isn't it? We're just going to have to live with it. And we all have to get it at some point, I suppose. And then we have to move on. So that's personally, I mean, I haven't known anybody who's had it yet. Apart from, well, that's not true. My daughter just got it, but she's way down south. However, professionally, it has been devastating, as it has been for many, many people. I mean, half my life is running an audio branding agency, which answers the question, how does your brand sound all over the world? And of course, branding, marketing, and in particular, audio branding can be seen as, you know, a nice to have, not an essential. And that kind of stuff gets kicked into the long grass very quickly when the world goes into a massive recession. And that's what's happened. So like a lot of other agencies, we've seen our revenues slashed by 2/3, 3/4.
Wow.
It's been very tough. And then, of course, my other life is, like yours, Craig, is speaking. And I'm sure you've experienced this. Travel restrictions rather put the mockers on that. So it's all moved virtual. There's less virtual stuff than there ever was physical stuff. Many, many conferences just got cancelled. Absolutely. Bookings got cancelled. A few years ago, Jane and I were travelling the world with our little daughter, Holly, going all over the place. And I was speaking about communication, about listening and about speaking to organizations and at big conferences and so forth. And that hasn't been the case for the last couple of years. You know, I do virtual work. I enjoy doing virtual work. In fact, I train on doing virtual work. But it's a different order of magnitude, as I'm sure you and every other professional speaker has experienced. So, you know, professionally, it's been a tough ride. Personally, I'm very grateful. I'm double jabbed. I haven't had it. Nobody in my immediate family up here has had it, although, as I say, my daughter's got it right now down in the south. But she's a young person. She's fit and healthy. So hopefully she'll come through it very quickly. But the world has changed, hasn't it? The world has changed forever.
And, it certainly has.
we all do a lot more of this, don't we? That virtual communication is it's here to stay.
I mean, it's really fascinating because, we, you know, for about 10 minutes, I ran around with my undies on my head thinking, this is the end of the world. What am I going to do? And, you know, and we, like you, I'm sure, Julian, I had nearly a year's worth of work booked, you know, and you get more all the time. But as a speaker or a, you know, somebody who's going to be facilitating programs or whatever, you're booked pretty much 12 to 18 months ahead, and all of that fell over. Mm. And yeah, it's just interesting then trying to take the skills that you have and share your thoughts and ideas and messages with a different operating system. And while, of course, Zoom and tools like Zoom are blessings because we can do this and we can still do some work, it's a completely different experience on a communication level, on a connection level, on a building rapport level, on an interactive level, when you don't have the physical energy of a bunch of humans in a room.
Yeah, the signals are missing. It's very tough. You're speaking to a camera, which doesn't give you much back.
I had to do a gig recently, and in fact, I did one this morning, which was okay. I spoke to 100 of Victoria, where we are most senior police women, and they were fantastic, and it was a good gig. But what was hard was I could only see six people, right? And I did another one more recently, and once I got on the call, there was no video. It was only audio. And I said to the lady, and this was with hundreds of people, I can't see anything. And she goes, oh, no, you can't see us. We can see you, though. Nice. So there's no visual feedback. There's no auditory feedback because all the mics are off. And I'm sitting in my house, in my studio, literally doing a monologue for an hour and thinking, this could be complete shit or this could be hitting the mark. You know, it's such a different experience trying to connect and interact and communicate when you don't have any of the normal stimuli coming back.
But you know something, Craig, actually there's a benefit here, which is that we have to work harder. We have to generate that connection somehow.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe it's a spiritual thing. I mean, I admit if there's no audio and no video, that does make it pretty tough because that's a stone wall. But if you can get, if you're getting audio, you know, Pythagoras in ancient Greece used to erect a screen in front of his lecturers so that his first year students couldn't see them, on the basis that seeing people is distracting. Wow. You learn by listening. And he wanted people to focus on listening. So to a degree, I think there is a small benefit to this form of communication, which is it makes us focus and concentrate harder in order to get those connections, if we care, of course. I mean, if we don't care, then we can switch the camera off and be doing our email or, you know, throwing darts at the wall or whatever it might be. But if you care and you're trying to get a message across, which, of course, is the secret of all great speakers, isn't it? That it's not about you. It's about the gift you're giving to somebody else. Mm. And, you know, I call that speaking into the listening. There's a listening you're speaking into, whether it's one person or 1,000 or 10,000. And the question to ask is, what's the listening I'm speaking into? And if you can't hear them and you can't see them, you really have to imagine that. You have to kind of make some sort of a metaphysical connection with those people. Even if you're wrong, you know, at least you can imagine what they're feeling, what they're doing, how they're receiving this. Because otherwise it's utterly sterile, isn't it? You're just talking to yourself, and that's pointless.
Yeah. I watched a bit of you and read a bit of you today. And if anyone wants to watch, well, there's a bunch of really good things, but if you want to watch something that I just really enjoyed, so one of your five TED Talks is called How to Speak So That People Want to Listen. And you talk on that a bit. And I looked at it and I went, 9 minutes, what is it? 9 minutes 58. It's had over 31 million views. And I went, I was thinking to myself, you're not going to be able to say much in 9 minutes, 9 minutes 58. I'm thinking, you said so much in 9 minutes 58. Like, I literally, I got 3 or 4 minutes in and I went, originally I was watching it out of obligation, and then I rewatched it out of fascination and curiosity. And so I watched half of it and I went, this guy's actually really good. So I went back to the start and I got a pen and paper and I took notes. But you do have an unfair advantage. You know what that is?
Go on.
You've got a fancy voice. You've got a posh voice, dude. You've got a posh, fancy voice. So you've got a 20% advantage over bogans like me.
Well, I think there's something in that, in that there are some voices and some accents, for example, that are received more easily than others. That, of course, can be changed by work. And the voice itself is something I train on a great deal. I mean, I talked in that talk, I talked about the vocal toolbox. And in fact, I'm just about to do a new series on that for salespeople. There are all these aspects to the voice that most people don't think about, and you can work on them. You know, it's a skill. Mm. It's a skill like riding a bike or playing the piano. Most people think that speaking and listening are capabilities. Well, they're not capabilities, they're skills. Listening in particular is ignored by almost everybody. So if you can work on these things, if you become a master of speaking and a master of listening, it radically alters your outcomes in life. You know, how do we persuade people? How do we get people on our team and enroll people in what we want to do? There's not much you can do in the world on your own. So if you want to build rapport, relationships, enroll people, inspire, lead, then speaking and listening are absolutely critical skills. And yet we don't teach them in school at all. In most cases, we expect children just to pick them up. And this voice, that, you know, the voice is an incredible instrument. I mean, I think I started that TED talk by saying the human voice, the instrument we all play. It is an amazing instrument. You think of, you know, Pavarotti or, you know, crowds of people screaming when there's a goal or whatever it might be. I mean, the human voice can express so much in war, in peace, in love, in music. And yet most of us take it entirely for granted and think it's a fixed thing. It's what I've got. I was given this. Well, no, you can change it. So, you know, I agree with you that accent can be an issue. I mean, there are people who run mega corporations who've grown up in places where there's an association that that accent is thick. You know, I mean, that's, you get that in the West Coast, in the West Country of England, where people talk a bit like that, you know. And, you know, if you were running a major organization saying, no, my shareholders, it wouldn't go down very well. So people change those things. You know, you speak into a listening, you have to think about what is going to land and what's my objective here. And then, of course, all the things in the vocal toolbox, the depth. I mean, my voice is not, it's not an accident. I've trained.
Right.
And therefore, I'm making the best of what I was given. And, you know, you can get people with squeaky little voices. Even there, you can go to a vocal coach and you can train, because we all have the same equipment. Well, most of us do. I mean, similar anyway. Yeah. Some of us are big people with deep voices. Some of us are small people with high voices. But we can make the most of what we're given by training and really exercising that skill.
Imagine rocking up to the boardroom going, all right, you geezers, eyes to me.
Exactly.
That's I'd love to open the annual conference with that. All right, you
it
blokes.
Might work, you know. In some companies, that probably does work. Now, with, you know, internet companies can be very left field, and they can really, you know, embrace cultures which would have been complete anathema a few years ago. But in the main, no, that wouldn't work very well.
It's funny how some. This is my experience. Tell me what I'm getting wrong, if anything. Some people are quite articulate and have good vocabularies, Julian, and they can, I guess, in a sense, speak well. Like, they're not stumbling and bumbling. They're articulate. They're not, you know, messing up their words, but they're not creating great connection. Like, they're not great communicators, although they can string some words together. And there's no kind of gaps and not too many ums and ahs. Mm. But what about the difference between just being articulate and being able to really create deep connection with other human beings?
Well, again, Craig, I think a lot of that comes from, I mean, where are you coming from? Is this about impressing people? Is this about looking good? Is it about being right? I mean, these are the two big human failings that I talk about a lot in my training. Looking good, you know, just if you go on stage or you're in a conversation and your intention is to impress somebody, yeah, to have them think you're wonderful, well, that's never going to work really well in the long term, because it's an ego-driven intention and it's all about me. Yes. And I'm not looking for a connection. It's not my intention to be connected with you. It's my intention to impress your socks off. And it's shallow. And you can tend to see that when people come on stage and it's all about them. You know, there's a feeling of, oh dear, a bit of an act going on here.
Mm.
So looking good is that's something which we need to look out for. And then being right is the other huge one, of course, which is so in play in the world right now. And if that's been inflamed by the internet, social media are creating these silos of people who are extreme in view and reinforcing each other's nuttiness. And unfortunately, listening, which is one of the reasons I bang on about listening so much, listening is the doorway to understanding. Listening is the sound of democracy. I mean, how can we live next door to people that we disagree with if we don't listen to them a bit and think, well, I don't agree with you, but I can see why you think that, maybe. Otherwise, you know, we're on a slippery slope to the ISIS view of the world, which is, you disagree with me, I'll kill you. And that's not a nice world to be in. So these are really fundamental human things, looking good and being right, that we need to challenge when we're speaking with somebody, because is it about that or is it about creating a connection?
Yeah.
Being in relationship. And that requires intimacy, which is, you know, opening up. I mean, people always say it's like into me, see. It's being humble, it's being vulnerable, it's opening up and giving something to the other person. It's all about the gift.
Yeah.
And then if we can establish that, then we're into rapport and deep relationship. And of course, you know, whether you're in a loving relationship, I mean, what's the most common complaint in loving relationships? He or she never listens to me. Or selling, you know, we've all had high pressure salespeople banging on and not listening to a word that we say, and not you know, completely missing the plot, selling something we don't need. Or whether it's leading people. I mean, I've been in companies where you get table thumping leaders who are just dogmatic and shouting at people. It doesn't work very well. In any case, in any of these situations, what we need to be doing is concerning ourselves with building that relationship, with making that connection. And so articulacy it's a wonderful skill. There is a problem with vocabulary in the world today. I mean, it's diminishing. I think there's like 500,000 words in the English language, give or take, in the big dictionaries. And, you know, there are teenagers who are using less than 1,000 a day, quite possibly 500, of which, you know, you can guess like would be very high up in the list. And
that would rate very, then don't forget the emojis. There's probably 9,000 emojis per day used.
Exactly. Yeah. So, you know, it's important to maintain that vocabulary because it's very frustrating to be inarticulate, not to be able to express oneself, but it's only a tool and it's not sufficient. You know, being blithe and brilliant and witty and so forth is all very well, but if it's all about impressing people, it's shallow and pointless, really, ultimately.
Because you're more about yourself than them, and if you're about yourself, you're not paying attention. I help out, not to the level that you do and not with the skill that you do, but, you know, fledgling speakers who come to me and want to kind of get started somewhere. I've been doing it since I was 26. I've been speaking professionally. That's 31 years. So I've done lots of it, but, you know, but still figuring it out and getting better, I think. But one of the things that I talk to people about, Julian, is the kind of the juggling act between, yes, you want to prepare and you want to have a plan and you want to have, you know, to a point, you know, if you need to, I don't use any, not that there's anything wrong with it, but I don't use video or PowerPoint because I kind of freestyle. But so there's this kind of juggling act maybe between how much do I plan and how much do I just be present? Because I've seen many speakers when I'm at conferences where they have a plan, they have their 12 or 15 slides And it doesn't matter. The audience could be literally walking out or falling asleep, or, and they're not present enough to kind of adapt to what's going on, because everything's so predetermined that they can't be in the moment. Is there a skill to being able to go in with a plan, but also be aware in the moment that this is not working, or maybe I need to change my energy or my language or my approach, or maybe I need to create a bit of interactivity with a question, or it's reasonably multi-layered.
Yeah, it is. No, you're absolutely right, Craig. I talk in, when I train on platform speaking, on presentation skills, which is, it's the last chapter of my online course. The whole chapter is devoted to this because, you know, like you, I've been doing this for decades and hundreds of times to audiences up to 11,000 people. And every mistake that could be made, I think I have made at some point. So it's quite nice to point the potholes out to people. I talk about PPD as the process. The first P is practice. And that's practice the skill of speaking, just becoming confident as a speaker. Many people have a fear of speaking, which is normally about looking stupid, forgetting the lines, you know, that kind of thing. But it just is practice. It's like anything else. You know, I would be terrified if you said to me, climb that mountain. And years of training later, I might be quite comfortable with the idea. If I've done it hundreds of times, I'd be very comfortable. You know, I might be hanging off an overhang with my fingertips, making a phone call. Who knows? Mm. People do that, don't they? You know, so pretty much anything in life, which is terrifying for the vast bulk of us, becomes less and less terrifying with practice. And that's what I talk about there. It's about practicing the skill. Toastmasters, a buddy group of people you put together and just present to each other and critique each other, whatever it is, doing it over and over again really helps. That's the skill. The second thing is, the second P is prepare. So you've got a gig, you've got a talk, you're going to propose marriage, you're going to ask for a raise, whatever it is, an important moment. Well, prepare for it. You know, what am I going to say? Who's the audience? What are they? What's the listening I'll be speaking into? How can I do this well? What are they going to connect to? There are three intentions at play here, and intentions are very important. There's my intention for me. What do I want to get out of this? There's my intention for them, which is the most important one. What do I want them to get out of this? So like with a TED talk, you have to take people on a journey from here to there so that in 12 minutes, they're in a different place. The world has changed for them somehow. And the third intention, that's the one you have to guess by that question, what's the listening, is what's their intention for them? Mm. Now, I can't know that, but I have to guess it.
Yes.
So think about those three things and prepare what you're going to say and how. Am I going to use aids? Am I going to use props? Am I going to be, you know, is this going to be lively or should I be very formal? What am I going to wear? How am I going to be? Mm. All of those sorts of things. We think about those things and by all means rehearse. I mean, my first TED talk, which is about the four effects of sound, that was the first time anybody had ever used sound in a TED talk. I rehearsed that so much. My daughter, Alice, who's now in her 20s, I mean, she was then 10, I think, she knew it as well as I did because she was my audience. I was delivering it with the TV behind me. The couch in front of me was the TED audience, to the point where I was not frightened of not knowing it.
Mm.
Now, that creates a liberation because I did not practice everything so that I could deliver exactly the same talk each time. I practiced it to the point where I knew it so well that I wasn't frightened I was going to get lost or anything like that.
Yeah.
So the D is deliver. And this is the same process that Olympic athletes would use. You know, they talk about practicing and they talk about preparing for the event and then they call it execute, which is a slightly violent word, I think. So I talk about deliver. And that's about walking on stage, being fully, fully present. And that's what people miss. You know, when they walk on and they're all in their self, you know, I'm going to deliver this talk. I'm going to do it well. It's all about, you know, inside stuff. It's about me delivering this thing. You walk on stage. It's about you connecting with the audience, about them. And having done all that groundwork, it's like jazz.
Mm.
You know the tune so well, you can then jazz with it, have fun with it, build that connection, be present to the people, be fully conscious with everything you're doing and fully conscious of how it's going down in the room, which is a wonderful moment. I mean, that's one of the reasons I love speaking. I'm sure you feel the same, Craig. It's one of the times when I'm on stage in front of hundreds or thousands of people, I'm really conscious because every gesture is intentional.
Yeah.
Everything I say is intentional. I'm really listening to the room. You know, I'm probably at the peak of being a conscious human being at that point. Thousands of eyes on you. You better be. Mm. So, and I love that. It really helps me to enhance my consciousness in the rest of my life as well. It's good practice.
And I love what you just said. I feel like that too. It's amazing that we have this ability to almost dial up this intuition or this ability to be fully present, and our energy goes to another level. And yeah, for me, that moment of being on stage and just connecting with that many souls, just connecting with that many minds and that many people, it's, you know, obviously for some people that would be totally terrifying, but obviously for you and I, that's, you know, that's part of what kind of lights our fire. Back to what you were saying about, you know, practice and becoming accustomed to, you know, being on stage. And one of the things that we talk about with my background in sports science, Julian, working with elite athletes, is being able to execute under pressure. Sorry, deliver under pressure. Let's chuck execute out. But so we talk about, there's a thing called the inverted U principle, which is about, basically talks about an athlete's level of arousal. What's the right level of arousal for optimal performance at that sport or task or activity? So, for example, for shot put, it's completely different to table tennis. For running 100 meters, it's completely different to running a marathon. What's the optimum level of arousal so that we can get the most out of our talent, our potential, our physiology? And it's interesting in, you know, when I talk to budding speakers about, you know, it's good that you've got knowledge. It's good that you're prepared. It's good that you, you've got some great ideas and thoughts and stories to share. Now you need to find a way to be in a very different situation that you're used to and to be calm, you know, and to be able to deliver. So that, because if your anxiety is 9.5 out of 10 or 11 out of 10, and you're overthinking everything and you're not fully present, despite the fact that you're knowledgeable and smart and well-equipped on an academic or an intellectual level, it's not going to be a great experience. And so kind of it's giving ourselves permission. I don't know if you say this to people, but I say, look, you can't get good at the thing that you don't do, right? You can't master what you avoid. So when you start, you're probably not going to be very good. And guess what? That's okay. Mm. But guess what? This is how you get good, is by first not being awesome. Like, yeah, how you become a black belt is by starting as a white belt and getting punched in the face, either literally or metaphorically on stage. Mm-hmm. And this, giving yourself permission to not be awesome, but to be okay and as well prepared as possible. And then whatever happens, it's a learning process.
Well, there's the four stages, aren't there, which I constantly try to explain to my six-year-old daughter, Holly, who expects to be good at everything first time and gets very cross if that's not the case. So the first stage is that you're unconsciously incompetent. In other words, a four-year-old doesn't know that the four-year-old doesn't know how to drive. It's not a problem. Then you become consciously incompetent. So you realize, I can't drive. And at the age of 13 or 14, that becomes a bit of a problem. So then you learn how to drive and you become consciously competent, gripping the steering wheel, white knuckles, concentrating on every moment, terrified of making a mistake. And after a while, you become unconsciously competent, which is when you're driving, you're thinking about anything but driving. What am I going to have for lunch? Having a conversation with somebody, doing, you know, astrophysical calculations, whatever it might be. So those are the four stages. But then you can transcend those and become also reflexively competent and teach, as indeed you do. So we all have to go through those, and accepting those is very, very important, absolutely. And that's why practicing in a safe environment, creating a safe container for practice is a really good idea, like Toastmasters or a buddy group or something like that, where it doesn't matter if you fail. We have to fail. That's how we learn. You know, any organization that's got some sort of, you know, philosophical different problem with failure, with making mistakes, is never going to be very innovative, because usually it's by making mistakes that we progress. It's by failing. As long as we're not doing the same fail over and over again, then that's how we learn.
You know, it's funny how, you know, a lot of the things that you're talking about now are brilliant. And also what you were, the talks that I listened to today, when you're saying all this stuff about, you know, pitch and pace and having silent moments of silence or gaps. Is it timbre of your voice? Is that the word?
Yeah. Timbre, yeah.
You know, and all of these, and I'm thinking, oh yeah, like all of this stuff is really important, but I really have never given it a lot of conscious thought. Mm. Like I've never thought a lot about my timing. I've never thought a lot. I mean, you know, a little, but or you know, the pitch of my voice, but it is so crucial, because when you know, there's somebody on stage sharing thoughts and ideas, so there's a couple of inbound kind of stimuli. One is what you're seeing. Two is the data or the information that's being transferred. But then three is the sound. It surprises me that this isn't being spoken about a lot more, but obviously you're the world leader in this space, so we're happy to have you. But where did your fascination with this and awareness of this come from? Like, what got you interested in, apart from, was it a musical introduction?
Yes, I have to share with you, I am a musician. And I think musicians listen to the world in a slightly different way to non-musicians. You have to, if you're playing in a band or an orchestra, you have a multi-track listening. You have to listen to a lot of different instruments at the same time. And it has to be also very intense conscious listening. Otherwise, you're not responding in real time to what's going on. You're not actually in the group, because a group is a gestalt. It's an organism, like a football team or anything else. It's an organism which has its own identity and its own soul, its own mind. And if you're not part of that, then the whole thing doesn't work very well. So, yeah, I think that's where it came from, really. And I spent years, I had a previous career built up a magazine publishing company in the UK. And that was dealing with big brands, producing lovely glossy magazines for them. So when I sold that, I wanted to bring the two halves together, because I was a musician all the way through that, listening and thinking the world doesn't sound very nice. And at the same time, I was thinking brands really need to communicate. So that's when I started the sound agency back in 2003. So it's 18 years ago now.
Wow.
With that question, how does your brand sound? So it was all about brands are all making noise, you know, and they spend trillions of dollars a year on how they look. And they don't think, how do we sound? Is that undermining how we look? You know, what's it like when you go in a supermarket? Does it sound nice? Mm. No, it normally doesn't. Or a shopping mall, or a shop which has got, you know, terrible music blaring out through a really low grade sound system, distorted, and it's noisy. And or a cafe where you're going for a quiet coffee and you have to bellow at somebody. You know, all of this stuff is going on because people aren't listening, organizations aren't listening, and that's because they're made up of people who aren't listening. So it all brought me back time and time again to listening. I guess the sound agency is attempting all the time to teach organizations to listen. Mm. And to create sound that's appropriate. You know, we've now got this wonderful mood sonic sound that we create, this biophilic nature-based sound, which helps people in workplaces. It helps them to concentrate by blocking out unnecessary conversation. And it helps them to stay well, because all this sound is now proven over and over again to be really good for us. The sounds of nature, water, wind, birds, and so forth, really good for our well-being. So that's a great product that we've now got, and we're excited about. And it's all, you know, it comes back to this thing of listening the whole time. And that's you know, where the TED Talks kind of led after a while. But it's quite interesting. My TED Talk on listening has been seen by only 1/5 as many people as my TED Talk on speaking. And I think that says something about the world.
That, you know,
we're far more into sending than we are to receiving. Listening is much more of a feminine sense. You know, it's more, you receive, the sound goes deep inside your head. You know, it touches you inside your head. You have no ear lids. You can't switch it off unless you put headphones on or put your fingers in your ears. So it's a passive receiving sense. Whereas speaking is much more, I think, of a masculine, outbound, directed sense. And unfortunately, social media have made this, you know, amped it up to a new level altogether, because they're all about broadcasting. It's like becoming a personal TV station, isn't it? Or radio station, tapping away, you know, I'm on a train. Who cares? You know, there's this fantasy that there are thousands of people hanging on my every word and move. But actually, I don't know what the number is. I would be really interested to know what's the average number of people who see a tweet as it floats past on the Twitter stream. Probably 1, 0.1, I don't know. So it's this fantasy land that we have this sort of imaginary audience around us, making us feel good because we're important. And I think that's really dangerous. It's so ego driven. And again, it's not about giving gifts to people as much as it is receiving adulation or demanding attention. And that's what a lot of the YouTube and Twitter sphere is about, unfortunately. So I think we're in a pretty dangerous place, given that we don't teach listening in schools at all. It's not even considered as a skill, you know. And how can teachers?
That's true. And you know what else we don't teach in schools? One of my favorite things to talk about, metacognition, which is thinking about thinking.
Oh yeah.
And what you're doing now is you're making me think about, not just about how I think, but how I communicate and connect. And I love what you said in one of your talks, which I found fascinating. I assume you were talking about male politicians, but you said that there's that male, politicians with deeper voices get more votes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, not just male. Margaret Thatcher had vocal training to lower her voice by two tones.
Wow.
Yeah, because she felt that when she spoke like this, you know, which she did at the end of her career, she was taken more seriously in the House of Commons because the voice was deeper.
Yeah.
And that's simply because we associate depth with size. You know, elephants have got deeper voices than mice, and you need to take an elephant more seriously because it's larger and therefore more dangerous. So it's a kind of genetic association of depth with importance or significance or whatever. But yeah, that's true. Other things being equal, we vote for politicians with deeper voices.
So from now on, everyone, the intro is going to be like, hello, everyone, welcome to the U Project. Now that's ridiculous. Even I hate that.
That may be, but I'll tell you, I'll give a tip to everyone listening to this, because it is important. You can move your voice in your body. We all obviously speak with our vocal cords, which are in the throat, but you can resonate in different places. So, for example, if I resonate in my nose, you get this rather more nasal voice. If I resonate in my throat, that's okay. That's where I typically will speak from. Most people do. But if I move it down and resonate in my chest, you can immediately hear the difference. And if you're a radio presenter, that's where you'd want to be, isn't it? Right down here. Not so, you know, you don't want to speak like this and make it unreal and ridiculous. But you can practice resonating in your chest simply by putting your hand on your sternum, that's the chest bone, and speaking, and get better and better at feeling the resonance in your hand as you speak. And it's just practice. And if you want to be taken more seriously in any situation, then it's quite a good idea to have that ability to resonate in your chest, because we tend to take people with deeper voices more seriously.
Mm. You're fascinating. This is fascinating. All right. Now, I know we've got to go soon because you've got stuff on, because you're a busy man. Now, obviously, you can work with companies around the world. You're not just limited to the UK, I guess.
Oh, absolutely. No, I live in Orkney, which is very, very remote. But thank goodness for virtual communication.
Yeah
we work with, the sound agencies working all over the world, America, the Middle East, Far East, Europe. with its soundscapes. And in Australia, actually, we've got a very, very good client in Australia. And for my course, of course, the course is online, so that's global immediately.
All right. So www.juliantreasure.com, juliantreasure.com. Anywhere else that they can find you, follow you, connect with you, good sir, my audience, that is?
Well, that's the best place. I mean, there's also the soundagency.com if they want to check out the audio branding side, and moodsonic.com for the wonderful soundscapes of nature. And just to say, anybody who comes by juliantreasure.com, and you might like this, Craig, there's a free download, which is a movie I made about 20 minutes long of me with a top American speaker coach called Neil Gordon dissecting that TED talk that you enjoyed so much and asking, why did it work? What did I do there that was right, that generated so many views and made it so successful? And it's a really interesting piece of, you know, it's actually putting it on the table and cutting it into tiny pieces and saying, well, that worked because, and then, you know, and then we could have done this and so forth. So that's free for anybody who comes by juliantreasure.com. And it's if anybody wants to speak in public, that's a really useful asset.
So good. And you know what? Just back to that that 9:58 talk, it's called, just to remind you, everyone, it's called How to Speak So That People Want to Listen. Now, what I would call talking to a cold audience, by that I mean talking to a room of people that don't necessarily know you or follow you, right? Doesn't mean they're bad people or they're not lovely, but right? Whereas, so when I started watching you, I was a cold audience member, right? Because I didn't know you. I'm like, ah, well, I'm chatting to this man tonight. I better find out who he is. So, and I would say a lot of the people in the audience you spoke to were also cold in the sense that they were there to see a bunch of speakers, of which you were one. Am I correct in saying that?
Absolutely right.
Yeah, right. So I've never seen anyone warm up a cold audience quicker than you did ever. And I've seen a lot of speakers. Like you had them in within 60 seconds, and it normally takes a while, and if people can do it at all. But yeah, you created instant engagement and connection. And so for those of you who are listening, and whether or not you want to be a speaker or you want to run your own programs or workshops or do online or offline, or you're a coach or you're a mentor or you're a teacher or a university lecturer, take a breath, Craig. That's important when you're communicating. Have a look at Julian's stuff, juliantreasure.com. And we really appreciate you chatting with us on the U Project today.
Well, Craig, it's been great fun, and good luck with your speaking career as well. And I'm sure you're going to be out there very, very shortly when this all blows over, which it ultimately will. But thanks. I've really enjoyed myself.
Yeah, pleasure. Stay there for one sec, if you would. We'll say goodbye to everyone. Thank you, everyone. Thank you, Tiff.
Thank you, boss. Thanks, Julian.
Thanks everyone. Love you guts. See you next time.